RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 9.
Into the Education Department. I have had much happiness in my time, and there was not a period in my life in which I completely missed that blessing. But the years preceding my 39th birthday were perhaps the best of all. I had my work among the blind, my literary interests, my church duties, and my pupils, many of whom proved loyal friends even to this present day. The one dark shadow was the increasing debility of my mother, for she was now 80 years old and already in the grip of the malady which broke her strong body in the end. My wonderful brother Stephen had stood by us both, yet I was not free from anxiety about my future in view of the low remuneration I was receiving as a teacher and a writer. One day there appeared a notice in the daily papers, announcing that the State Department of Education was about to appoint a head teacher for the School for the Blind. Remembering the old cry that blind teachers were not gifted with the capacity to teach their fellow blind, I let the notice pass with little further thought. But my friend Mr. Charles Monteith, who had been working with me in the cause of the sightless, came to me and suggested that I apply for the position, as he considered that I had both knowledge and experience to bring to such a task. So I wrote to the Director of Education, stating my case, and received an answer from his secretary, to the effect that the position would be advertised and that an application from me would be considered with any others which might come in. In due time, the official notice appeared, and I lodged my claim, with particulars of my qualifications and personal testimonials, from people whom I thought worthwhile. I was the selected candidate. Somewhat to my surprise, and feeling confident that I could do the job, I was well pleased to look forward to the satisfaction of winning my bread in a sphere of labour that would at the same time realise my ideals. The salary was £150 a year, and if I succeeded, the place would be permanent. A very welcome change to one who had suffered from great variations in income, as all music teachers must, unless they hold regular appointments in churches or schools. I went through the necessary formal interviews, the medical examination, and so on, and then waited for the termination of the Christmas holidays to be presented to my school. Instead, I was called up to the Education Department, and there I was informed by Mr. Fussell, the chief inspector, that the management of the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind had refused to let me into the school, as it had no confidence in a blind teacher and would not sacrifice the children in such a matter. Needless to say, this was a blow which I had not anticipated. I had supposed that where I could satisfy the experts in charge of the state system, I was not likely to meet with serious opposition from the board of the school, especially as payment of my salary would relieve the hard-pressed funds of the institution. I suggested to Mr. Fussell that it would have been fairer had they given me a trial before taking such a step, and he agreed. So great was my distress at being the cause of such embarrassment to a department which had shown itself progressive enough to appoint a blind officer, that I asked if it were desired that I should withdraw my application. But the chief inspector said, "No, no. This is our affair. We have appointed you, and until we are convinced that you cannot do the work required, we intend you to remain with us. In the meantime, in order that you may receive your salary, you must sign on and attend one of our schools. Could you do that?" I assented to such an arrangement. "Then go home now, and you will receive instructions when and where to report for duty." I came out of that interview with a great weight of trouble on my mind, for I could not persuade myself that my blindness was the main reason for such extraordinary conduct on the part of the board of the institution. I knew that my work in connection with the Association for the Blind had not met with the warm approval of the older organisation, but throughout the 17 years I had led the work for our adults, I had been more than careful not to quarrel with the Royal Victorian Institute, and our activities only covered those spheres which had been untouched by theirs. I decided, however, not to open up this discussion with my superior officers, but to do as ordered and wait for their instructions. In a day or two the notice came. I was to report for duty at the State School in Queensbury Street, Carlton. The headmaster received me very kindly, but with some embarrassment, as he did not know exactly what to do with a blind practicing teacher. I asked what instructions he had been given for me, but he had none, and advised me to sit about in the various classes and listen to what was going on, or amuse myself in any other way I cared to. "Doubtless," he added, "you will pick up some useful hints, although I am aware that the work we will have to do is very different from what we do here." He then sent for Miss Elsie Lang, the infant mistress, and told her to look after me, and let me do as I liked, which was, in fact, nothing as far as he was concerned. This was the beginning of a 4 months' experience which I shall never regret. At first I felt a little helpless in this busy hive, but I soon found some jobs to do. I played the piano for the marches and singing lessons, told the stories to the babies. Then I got into the handwork section, and had daily allotments in the raffia and knitting classes. Now and then I took lessons in English appreciation, arranged songs for some of the other teachers. Indeed, it was not very long before I was working full-time and enjoying it too. I did most work in the infant room, where Miss Lang proved a true and faithful monitor, and lent me valuable aid in bringing my teaching practice up to date. By and by, the headmaster was called upon to furnish a report on my case. How glad I was then that I had insisted on doing all I could in the unexpected circumstances in which I had been placed. Of course, I did not know what was sent into headquarters, and my next excitement was the visit of an official inspector, before whom I took my turn at a demonstration lesson in company with other practicing teachers. This gentleman gave me a good report, as Mr. Fussell stated later, and the department was thus satisfied that I had initiative and teaching ability in an ordinary school, at least. During these months, I learnt much that was not in the school curriculum. It will be remembered that this particular shrine of learning lies close to a poor and miscellaneous population, and that the children handled were of many races and from different stratas of society. Now and then they gave me a peep into their home life. Dear, lovable little brats that they were. One day I was having a talking lesson with the tinies, and the device that day was to ask what they would like to be when they grew up to be men and women. The answers were enlightening. Luigi wanted a barrel organ with a monkey on it. Dick would have a big broom and sweep the gutters. Robert had aspirations to the heights of chimney sweeping, while Charlie wanted to be a burglar. When I asked for a reason for this last choice, the wee boy said, "Because you break into people's houses at night and cut their throats." The bloodthirsty little ruffian was one of the mildest nippers in the class. A band of bigger boys soon constituted themselves as my knights, and would take turns to meet me at the tram in the morning and escort me back there when school was over. The little girls were not to be beaten either. They undertook to wash my teacup after lunch each day, and incidentally to eat up any slice of cake or biscuits which proved too much for my appetite. Children about that district did not always get enough to fill their little stomachs from the home larder. The weeks slipped on, and at last once more I was summoned to the head office. There I was told that I was to go to my own school for a 3 month trial, and that Inspector Gates would go down with me and see me settled in. I met Mr. Gates at the school. There was a lot of talk about burying the hatchet and about getting on together. My department had been told, I learned, that I was quarrelsome, difficult to get on with. In consequence, I was warned to avoid all friction, to withdraw for the present from my public association with other blind movements, and to do my utmost to justify the trust that had been reposed in me. There was no course open but to acquiesce, although I am sure my superiors never guessed what a burden they laid on me, nor how defenceless it left me in the face of purposeful opposition. I resolved that if quarrels occurred, they should not be of my making, and that I would endure much so as to maintain the desired equilibrium between the Institute and my department. From the moment of my initiation to the work, I knew that trials and heartaches lay ahead. That first day was shadowed by the violence of the opposition that had kept me out for so many months. As Mr. Gates and I arrived, the children were singing the two-part song, I Would That My Love. Ever since then, I have disliked that really beautiful melody. But I was now in my rightful place, and if ever a woman was determined to prove her worth, that woman was myself. Starting out on a new career at 39, to which I honestly believed I had a call, and as I had overcome in a school conducted for the seeing, I knew that I could win here. School teaching years. In making a brief record of the next few years of my life, I wish I could state that my forebodings on entering my school were unfounded, but I had not been long in my new position before I realized that all the talk about the buried hatchet was empty air. That weapon, figuratively speaking, was ever at hand to give me a tap on the head, or a more smashing blow to my self-esteem, whenever the chance was possible. There was the intense loneliness among people who did not trust me. The strained relations which had been created by my appointment had a psychological effect on the whole staff, of a kind which I had never previously encountered before. The juniors seemed to think it their duty to endorse the verdict of the management, so I was left severely alone, as a dangerous person, one impossible to get on with, and best avoided. Hence I was virtually sent to Coventry, and treated with cool civility, but with no friendliness. At this distance of time, I can see more clearly the difficult situation which faced all those employed by the Institute. A subconscious barrier was set up between them and me, beyond which they thought it most unwise to penetrate. One member of the staff actually told me that it was more than his position was worth to be caught talking to me in a friendly fashion. But I do not believe that this was true, only that it indicated certain subterranean heat generated by my enforced presence in the school. Little by little, my relations with my fellow teachers improved, yet they were paid by the institution and knew the barrier must still be observed while allowing cooperation in the work. Making a supreme effort to ignore any opposition, I took to my duties with energy and enthusiasm, and the children responded splendidly to my efforts. I was placed in charge of the highest class, which was then about Standard 4 of the state schools, and I aspired to raise the standard of education to that of seeing children generally. To attain this goal, I worked at a terrific pressure. In the evenings, I transcribed Braille, arithmetic, and other textbooks, as there were no modern aids of this kind in the school. In addition, I copied choice selections from the school papers, which I made available for individual reading, to keep my young folks up to date in some measure. In this work, I had the help of a dear-sighted friend, Miss Alice Coleman, later Mrs. Purse Cumming, who had been a music pupil of mine at Mooney Ponds, and who clung to our friendship, even till her death in the winter of 1944. Not to fall behind was the aim of my life in those strenuous years. My classes made good progress, and the annual inspector's examination were always satisfactory. The grade was going up, and we began to have plans for some higher education as well. At this point, it may be stated that I launched two scholars out into secondary schools and laid the foundation for the higher honours of which the school rightly boasts today. The going was hard, however. Interference with the regularity of the curriculum was often great. The barber came in school hours, likewise the dentist and the tailor. All music lessons clashed with some subject in school for each individual child, and I was constantly striving to make up this time so that the pupil should not fall behind the class. I recall one inspection in which a certain boy failed completely in grammar. The fact was he had never been present at the grammar lesson since it was his half hour for piano instruction. The constant interruption of the programme struck me so forcibly that I decided to keep records for a half year. At the end, I found that every child in my division had been absent for one-third of the hours, and in this record I did not include any leave for sickness. There seemed no way of avoiding this, at least in the realm of music lessons, for the practice and enjoyment of music is an indispensable part of the education of the blind child. Perhaps the greatest annoyance in the way of interruption was the presence of swarms of sightseeing visitors. Money appeals were being made, and every time the deluge flowed in, genuine work had to be set aside and the smartest pupils trotted out to demonstrate with items long since mastered. Again, in voicing this complaint, I am forced to acknowledge that the nuisance is unavoidable while the school is conducted as a public charity. The raising of funds is such a task that every means must be used to that end. But I assert with both warmth and bitterness that blind children should no more depend on charity for an education than their sighted brothers and sisters. This perpetual begging cry is detrimental in many ways. It robs most of its victims of initiative, accustoms, if not drives them, to mendicancy, that is, as a group. It deprives the blind child of the well-to-do citizen of the best available training because the parents of such children will not use a charity as the school for their sons and daughters. And besides all this, it makes the weaker ones expect to have done for them many things that they could profitably do for themselves. So in the sum of it, this charity business is no good at all for our handicapped children. Feeling strongly on this question, it may be imagined that I was often unhappy when insensate strangers stood before my scholars and passed rude and audible remarks about any peculiarity, or sniffed in maudlin and futile pity where no pity was needed. If they could have heard the comments of the brighter youngsters after their departure, they might have been more restrained. Such trials added to my difficulties, but they were of a general description and shared by all the teachers. However, it is natural that personal prod should occupy a large place in the vista, and I was no exception. The steady and covert opposition was the hardest to bear. There were slights and tricks lying in wait, and I never knew where they originated. I think you will recall that I was to have a 3-month trial before I should be appointed permanently. At the end of this period, Mr. Gates visited me and inquired if I had met the committee. I had not seen one member and said so. About a week passed, and one day at the lunch hour, the housemaster informed me that he had leave for the afternoon and was leaving his division to me to do the best I could. Half an hour later, a lady assistant informed me that she had been sent to the city on some business for the management and supposed I would be able to keep her small scholars profitably employed and not to bother about the regular programme. At this I was a little upset, for until that day I had not been alone in charge of the whole school. I made no comment, however, and set about planning my afternoon's work, for I knew that if I claimed to be qualified I must be prepared to meet emergencies and to shoulder whatever came my way. With older scholars as monitors for the little ones, and a set composition for a few, I launched the rest of the boys and girls on a lively spelling bee, to which a couple of small prizes were attached as a stimulus. This exciting job was at its highest, when suddenly I heard footsteps coming along the passage outside, and next moment I had half a dozen members of the board in the schoolroom, conducted by the superintendent, and with them a representative of the education department. To them I explained the absence of the other teachers and told them what exercises were in progress. I am thankful to say that the children were happily employed, the discipline was satisfactory, and the inspection went off without any mishaps. After that, I did not hear anything more about a 3-month trial, and my appointment was duly gazetted. Another matter which held up the final decision was the problem of securing the necessary insurance, which at that time took the place of the regular contribution to a superannuation fund. I interviewed some of the leading companies and found that the life of a blind person was not regarded as a good risk. Some absolutely refused to consider an application, while others wanted to load me to such an extent that a policy would have been a very unsound business proposition for the one who paid the premiums. I went to the chief inspector about it and placed the facts before him, and he advised me to ask that my appointment be made with exemption from insurance. So this condition was gazetted by the governor in council when my appointment was later confirmed. As an offset, I pledged myself to do my best to make provision for my future, and could show that I had already begun to do so by purchasing a small cottage in Moonee Ponds, and by taking up an endowment policy with the Temperance and General Association, for that company had been more liberal in its appreciation of my needs. Meanwhile, the months mounted up into years, and with their passing, I did not find the opposition abate. The annoyances were perhaps trifling at times, but our daily experience is generally made up of small things. Nothing that could be kept from me was allowed to reach my ears, and if I chanced to make a casual inquiry, I was coldly rebuffed for stepping over my well-defined limits. One day the ward's maid came to the schoolroom and informed me that matron wanted all the girls. I asked the reason, and got the emphatic reply, "Matron wants all the girls." I sent them out and went on with the class to the half-dozen boys remaining. Presently the girls began to trickle back, and I seized on the first to arrive. "What were you wanted for?" I asked. "Oh, Miss Aston," she whispered, "so-and-so has things in her head." So that was it. One of the children had been away for a weekend and had contracted pediculosis. Certainly most vexatious in a school of model cleanliness. But why the clean-up should be done in school hours puzzled me, and why an explanation could not have been made to me, to the teacher, for the loss of nearly half a day's work, puzzled me still more. I tried to laugh at such happenings, even if it cost me a mighty effort. Sometimes I felt that deliberate attempts were made to undermine my influence with the scholars. They were told at times, when they chanced to quote me, as children will, their teachers, that Miss Aston was blind and didn't know. Now and then they would flare up from my smouldering torture fierce fires of rage that I must suppress, and I fear that on both sides there was suspicion, distrust, and dislike. I would say to myself, "This will break you if you give way, so hold fast to the reins, old girl." I read somewhere the epigram, "Rage is futile," and I knew it was. This was an atmosphere so foreign to my nature and experience that at times I could scarcely breathe in it. I struggled on for 12 years, resolved that I would see it through till my legal retirement, or until the cord of my will and purpose snapped in spite of me. Only once did I come near to giving up. It was on a day when a throng of visitors from my own district of Essendon was sightseeing at the school, and the official conducting them made some disparaging comments in my hearing about my lack of qualifications. I shall never forget the spasm which seized me. I could barely walk, but I managed to get to a seat in the boys' playroom, where I sat and tried to get a grip of myself. I belong to a breed that is not exactly humble. It was more in my line to hit back, and this I dared not do, remembering the injunction of my department to keep the peace. I went back to my classes, but the crowd had moved on to the other sites, and the afternoon ended at last. I longed to get to a quiet spot where I could ease my burning heart with tears, and I set out for my home. As I walked toward Greville Street, there faintly reached me from the buildings of Wesley College the chords of Rachmaninoff's Prelude, and to a spirit battered as mine had been, it conveyed a sense of utter loneliness and misery. It took me by the throat, and I should have fallen but for the fence. I leaned my face against the cold iron and shuddered and wept until I felt calmer. Fortunately, nobody passed just then, and by degrees I recovered my composure, dried my eyes, and made for this haven of rest, where Miss Lawson comforted me and helped my resolution to persist. I thought that day that I could bear no more. But many years followed, through which brighter threads wove in and out. I got to love the children with their quaint sayings and trusting ways. I gradually reached a comfortable understanding with my fellow teachers, and there was pride in the successes of the brighter pupils. The principal interest of my private life was the building of my home in this old cottage, where I have realized the hopes of these stormy times, that here I should find a tranquil old age when my teaching days were over. I am aware, as I bring this chapter to a close, that the story it contains is rather painful, and to some it may seem unnecessary that it should be written. However, it is the explanation of many phases of my life which have puzzled friends, and if such folk will give a little thought to what it was like, short of persecution in certain quarters, they will understand the hardening effect it must have had upon my later conduct.
That brings us to the end of Episode 9 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.